this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, folks, Cameron Young might not be number one in the official world golf ranking, but you'd be hard-pressed to find a player who is operating at a higher level right now. A winner by six shots, the Cadillac Championship at Doral. Rex, is this simply David Duval in disguise, the new Cameron Young?
It feels that way. I mean, I think everyone sort of equated it to that when he won late last season on the PGA Tour for the first time. I think sometimes when we see talented players like a Cam Young, we put expectations a little bit greater than they probably should be, because I think we tend to discount how hard it is to win on the PGA Tour. But getting that breakthrough and then picking right back up where he left off at the Players Championship in commanding fashion, we can go back and revisit what he did coming down the stretch at TPC Sawgrass. I think both of you and I are still enjoying that final round all these weeks later. And now this, it's wire to wire at Doral, a big ballpark, a golf course that everyone said was going to test the world's best. It didn't test Cam Young. I mean, 19 under on that golf course is something I wanted to, as just sort of a snapshot in history, I wanted to compare statistically what it was like the last time the PGA Tour played at Doral in 2016 versus this time, 2026, 10 years later.
Adam Scott won in 2016 in the top five in 2026. Amazing.
Still in the field. Yeah, it's so cool. But just to give you an idea, Adam Scott won at 12 under par back in 2016. And you can probably discount some of that for weather. I think they had, except for Sunday, pretty much perfect weather down at Doral. You got a little bit of wind, but not like they're accustomed to. I think the bigger deal is if you look at the added yardage this time around. It played 7,739 yards this time around. It was 7,543 back in 2016. The scoring average this time was almost more than a full shot under par. It was 70.835 compared to 72.85 back in 2016. Let everyone on social media have at it. The golf ball goes too far.
I mean, it is a beastly golf course. And if you took Cameron Young off the leaderboard, it was a great test of golf. Scottie Scheffler won the B flight at 13 under par. Again, when conditions were pretty favorable, you didn't have the wind blow as it typically does in South Florida. That's really the main defense of the golf course, in addition to all the penalties, all the bunkers, all the hazards, and the like. Cameron Young just played unbelievable, sublime golf. I think this is further proof that when he gets going, and we're going to talk about his putting here in a second, he's really, really hard to beat. You can count on one hand the number of players who, at their best, would be able to topple Cameron Young, and I think there's growing evidence that it might not even be enough to count on one hand. I was a little bit facetious, Rex, coming off the top with the David Duval comp. However, it is kind of interesting, because David Duval, you think back to the mid-1990s, he had 7 runner-up finishes, then he won 13 times in the next 5 years. That, of course, included a stint at world number one. Also won a major championship. Cameron Young, a bevy of runner-up finishes on the PGA Tour in the first couple years of his career, went 90-plus starts without a victory prior to last summer at the Wyndham Championship. Now, Cameron Young has 3 wins in his last 14 events. He said afterward on Sunday, telling reporters in Miami, that once you win one, it's easier to win another. But, I mean, this is the proverbial gates being unlocked. I mean, the guy is just absolutely free-flowing at the moment. You look at what he's done over the past 2 months in particular. The confidence is growing. The game is getting incrementally better. And now the self-belief, the attitude, the confidence, they're all flowing as well.
Yeah, sleeping giant was kind of what I was thinking of as you're watching him come down the stretch. Again, on a really, really hard golf course, which should have been a really hard golf course. You're right. If you take him out of the mix, it plays very similar to what it played back in 2016. We're probably not having a conversation about the golf ball in that situation. But when you look at what he was able to do, and it wasn't even close, and I love the idea. It was a little bit weird on Sunday. They had to move up tee times. They went off both for 1 and 10. They were trying to beat a storm in threesome. So it was a little bit weird, but you still sort of had that dynamic between he and Scotty. And I thought it was going to be fun for a moment. Like, there was a 15-minute window. I know you and I always seem to want to do this on a Sunday afternoon at a Ryder Cup, saying that, no, it was exciting for exactly 42 minutes on Sunday afternoon. And normally both of us are wrong. Last time, maybe that was the case. But there was a window early in that round when Scotty Scheffler seemed to send a statement with what he did on the first hole, going driver and driver, had a chance for eagle, looked like it could be a 2-stroke swing. Of course, we're going to talk about the penalty that Cam Young called on himself during the round. You thought maybe he could make up some ground. This is the world number one. And he wasn't making up any ground. It was clear the conversation early in the round was, well, if Cam just shoots even par, that he should still cruise to victory. He had no interest in that whatsoever. I will say, and I know you were doing a little tongue-in-cheek with the David Duval comparisons, but I will say I like statistically the idea of both these players needed to learn how to win. I like that both of them opened up the floodgates and suddenly understood that I don't have to be my best. I think that was the message coming out of Cam Young, at least at the Players Championship, where he realized that I don't have to be perfect to win on the PGA Tour, not even at a big event like the Players or at the Cadillac Championship. Where I'm curious these lines are going to diverge is my guess, is David Duval got to the top of the mountain, you pointed out, won a major, got the world number one, and realized that this is it. This is what I spent all those years climbing. This is all those years I spent working. I can't imagine Cam Young's going to do the same thing. He seems so well-grounded with his family, with his father, with his mother, with his wife, with all of his kids.
His faith, yep.
I think everything about Cam Young is, and this isn't to disparage David Duval at all. I think it was a little bit different situation with how David Duval was brought up to be this prodigy as opposed to Cam Young. And you and I both have spent a good amount of time talking with Cam's dad. And it seems as if Cam wanted everything that his dad put on him. It was Cam who told his mom and dad, I think he was a teenager, not only am I going to play in the Ryder Cup, I'm going to play in the Ryder Cup at Bethpage, which for a teenager at that point was quite the statement. So I love the idea that he has this burning desire. I love the idea that, yes, his dad is a PGA of America pro. He had this built-in sort of mentor that allowed him to create this perfect swing. It was so much fun watching Cam Young tee off and then watching Scottie Scheffler tee off, because it's such vastly different ways to play the game. If I just drop someone down into my living room and told them that they're playing the same game, do you think they are? They probably would have been like, no, those two aren't playing the same game.
I mean, Scottie certainly has that gear where he can gear back a little bit and hit it 10 to 20 yards further than his average. Cam Young is just full throttle, all gas, no brakes the entire time, which I agree with you, is really, really fun to watch. You mentioned David Young, Cam's father, and this was not sort of external expectations that were placed on Cam Young as a youngster. This was all an intense internal desire to be great. And at least up until this year, he has really struggled with being a little bit too hard on himself. And that's not atypical for players who reach this level. Justin Thomas, I would argue, is sort of cut from the same cloth, where he's really, really hard on himself, sometimes to his own detriment. But I think it's really fun now, Rex, to see a player who is coming to his own from a belief standpoint, from a confidence standpoint. I would even argue from an attitude standpoint. The physical tools have always been there. Yeah, he's driving the golf ball at a incrementally better level than he has previously in his PGA Tour career. You look at what he's doing with his irons. They're certainly better than they were in 2025, but just sort of tightening up some of the windows and the dispersion in that respect. Again, those are incremental improvements for a great player of his caliber. You look at what he's doing on the greens. That has been a sizable difference over the past 2 years, what he's done. But again, you listen to Cameron Young, and he made a couple of tweaks with his setup. He brought in a new caddy who's a great green reader. And all of those little things from a physical standpoint can certainly make a difference. What I'm noticing, though, Rex, is a difference in attitude and sort of the comfort that he has in these positions. Keep in mind, when he won that Wyndham Championship for his first PGA Tour win and the floodgates seemed to open, he dusted the field by 6 shots. And so he was trying to learn how to win for the first time, and he didn't just win, he won in dominating fashion. You look at what happened at the Players' Championship, that was entirely different, where he just sort of hung around, let others make a mistake. He hit a great shot on the 71st hole of the golf tournament, hit the drive of his life on the 72nd hole of the golf tournament, and won with a par. This, I think, was a tour de force and should send a signal to the Rorys and certainly the Scotties of the world, because Cam Young played with Scottie for 3 of these first 4 rounds, that when I'm at this top gear, I'm incredibly difficult to beat. Cameron Young shoots 64 in the opening round. He leads at the halfway point by 5 shots. He leads at the 54-hole mark by 6 shots. And on Sunday, you mentioned it was 15 minutes of maybe a little bit of intrigue. I'm not even sure it was 15 minutes. Maybe when the ball moved and he had to take a penalty and he ended up making a par on his own.
Got my attention.
Like, that was it. That was like a 3 or 4 minute span for Cameron Young. He was never seriously threatened on a golf course where there's a lot of trouble. There's a lot of hazards. There's a lot of water. We saw the sand. It was potentially getting plug lies all over the place. The wind picked up in advance of the storm. Like, anything could have happened. And Cameron Young was never seriously challenged while playing with the world number one alongside him. From an attitude standpoint, I'm seeing an incredible shift from Cameron Young over the past couple of months. I think that's the most fun aspect to see. Not the physical standpoint, which was always, all those tools were apparent. I'm talking from a mental headspace.
And I think, to your point, the last couple of months, and you keep connecting these dots and didn't just come out and say the quiet thing. It's since the Ryder Cup, really. Yes, he had won at the Wyndham Championship before the Ryder Cup, but I don't know if you can discount how much pressure, how much that meant to him, having grown up essentially in the shadow of Bethpage, to play in your first Ryder Cup, which brings an enormous amount of pressure, just that alone. You're going to step to that first tee. You're going to start feeling things that you've probably never felt as a professional golfer in your life, and to do it in front of the home crowd and to be successful at it. I think he did things over the course of that week that he still falls back on. You and I talked to his dad about this at the Players Championship, about if there was any doubt whatsoever after getting that first win at the Wyndham Championship. I think it went out the window as soon as he showed up at Bethpage. They talked about it on the telecast. When you look at the putt he made on the final hole, at the end of the day, it didn't matter. The United States was going to lose that Ryder Cup. But he didn't know that in the moment. It was such a big moment. I would compare it to the emotions, the adrenaline, everything that's running through his body, to what Shane Lowry experienced when he actually won the Club Cup. And I think that speaks to where he is right now mentally, because you're absolutely right. He's not blinking under any circumstances. Coming down the stretch at TPC Sawgrass, Matt Fitzpatrick was making it difficult for him. Like, he wasn't giving it away. It was a game. He had to execute the best shot that's ever been hit in the shot link era on the 18th tee. It's a 380-something ridiculous yards. It's set up just a flip wedge into that hole. Things that we haven't seen before. And yes, I love watching him hit driver. And you're right, it's all send. He doesn't have an off-speed pitch, and maybe he'll develop one over time. But that's not
with the driver. He does not have an off, like. With his iron play, he's very, very artistic and creative.
And I will say, and look, we can probably say this about most of the players inside the top 10 right now, they got to this point not because of what they were able to do with their ball striking. My guess is he's been a great ball striker since he was in college, even before that, given who his dad is. It's what he's been able to do with his putting the last 2 years, I would say. Again, if he just putts average, like we used to say about Scottie Scheffler, he's probably going to have a good chance of winning. This week, he putted above average, and he absolutely railroaded the field.
Yeah, he most certainly did. I think you make a great point about the Ryder Cup. So the Ryder Cup proved that he could handle the arena. The Players' Championship proved that he could win a tournament of that stature. I think the Cadillac Championship proved, if anything, that he can be that dude. Look at the top players in the world. What are they? They can be dominant. Roy McIlroy stamped himself as a player for the ages by winning major championships by 8 shots. Scottie Scheffler has won all of his major championships by 3 or more shots. Cameron Young now has won 2 of his 3 events by 6 shots. That's dominant. That shows a top level that not every player has. He quite frankly bullied and put Scottie Scheffler in a locker over 3 of these first 4 days, including in the final round. Very, very impressive. Who would, is Cameron Young your no-brainer at this point, Rex, player of the year? Because I mean, I knew it. It's easy to forget that Cameron Young shot 73 in the opening round of the Masters. Remember, he went out in 40 on that front side. Or he could have already won a major championship. But look at what he did the rest of the week. Shot 67, 65 in that second and third round. Had the lead on the front side as well on Masters Sunday before his putter eventually went cold. We've had great stretches so far the first 4 months of the PGA Tour season. Chris Goddard has won twice. Matt Fitzpatrick has won 2 golf tournaments, nearly won a Players Championship as well. And now Cameron Young is a multiple-time winner, signature event, and a Players Championship. To me, I would put him ahead of the class right now.
Yes, and I was about to bring that up because you kind of caught me flat-footed. I think it was a couple weeks ago when you asked me who would be the player of the year right now, which is a little weird to
there
do
was
that
no, spring. So, there was no great answer. That was the amazing part.
The answer was there was no obvious choice. I kind of felt bad after the fact because I probably should have said Chris Goddard in the moment. He was the only multi-time winner, and I think that would have been the fair way to handle it in the moment. I think right now it's pretty clear it's Cam Young because you look at the quality of wins, and you're right. You look at what he did at the Masters. If not for a stumble early, we would have been maybe even having a holy – different conversation about Cam Young right now. When you look at what's coming up on the horizon, obviously next week or this week in Charlotte, Quail Hollow, great golf course for him. Looking ahead the week beyond that, Ronimac for the PGA Championship. Again, a Northeast golf course where you would think he would feel the most comfortable. And then you go to the essentially his neighborhood again at Shinnecock for the U.S. Open. You have to like him for all three of those starts.
Who's the best player in the world right now, Rex? When you look at the official world golf ranking, it's not anywhere close. And you look at what they've done, let's call it over the past year and a half, it's pretty overwhelmingly in Scotty's favor, right? Like Scotty has beaten Cam Young head-to-head 17 of those 23 starts in that span. That includes two major championships. But when you look at what Cam Young has done over the past 2 months, I think when the PGA Tour went to Florida and he really took it up a notch, he's gone third, win, third at the Masters, finished in a tie for 25th at the RBC Heritage, which of course Scotty lost in a playoff, but that was after putting really poorly and having sort of the letdown after that Masters Sunday, an opportunity to win his first major championship. And now he has a win in a signature event. He might not be the number one player in the world right now, but I think you could at least make a compelling case that he is the top. He's the player in the top form right now with the year's second major on the horizon.
No, I think that's 100% fair. And we could have this conversation. I had it with my son just 2 weeks ago. He asked about, can someone overtake Scotty at world number one this week? And I go, this week? And I go, no. I don't think anybody can overtake him this year. And that's if Scotty doesn't play. Again, that's probably an exaggeration mathematically, but he has a Tiger Woods-like commanding lead in the world ranking. And you and I always default to Data Golf, and we're going to do something fun later in the show. We're going to do a draft, and I spent a lot of time studying Data Golf this afternoon because I had to catch up on exactly where I would rank the LIV players. Giving away here, we're doing a draft of LIV players later in the show, so don't go anywhere, please. And even Scotty's lead in Data Golf is commanding, not quite as much as it is in the official world golf ranking, but you're absolutely right. So that I brought it up when you were doing the Open. Cam Young moved to third. He jumped past Matt Fitzpatrick, and he's still roughly a full point behind Rory for second place. But if you take out that two-year rolling window, which is, I would say, the beauty of the world ranking, we can sit here and complain about it, but it works, I would argue. Maybe not perfectly at the moment because of what's been going on with LIV Golf the last 4 years, but it works because it doesn't allow you to become a prisoner of the moment. Because I remember a time when you and I both were early at golfchannel.com when we would do sort of our weekly hot list. I think we would do 5 or 10 players, whatever the case may be. And we would make the adjustments. And clearly, Cam Young would probably be number one on both of our lists right now. But that sort of overlooks the body of work over at least the last year. And I think what Scotty has done deserves that commanding lead. But you're right. Right now, Cameron Young, I would put him head-to-head against anybody in the world, which is pretty amazing. Because if we were having this conversation at this point last year, I'm not quite sure he'd be in my top 5. Maybe not even in my top 10.
With Cameron Young? I mean, yeah. At this point last year, Cameron Young was 150th in Data Golf ranking. Entering the Cadillac Championship, he was 6th. Figures to move up at this point. The official world golf ranking did just update a very interesting point here, Rex. The difference between Scottie Scheffler and Roy McIlroy from numbers 1 to number 2 is about 7 points. That difference is the same as Roy McIlroy at number 2 and number 30 on the list. So, yes, it is commanding with Scottie Scheffler's lead. Speaking of Scottie Scheffler, he did birdie 3 of his last 4 holes for 68. Now has 3 consecutive runner-up finishes on the PGA Tour with the Masters, RBC Heritage, and now at Doral. First player to do so since Sergio Garcia in 2014. If you're Scottie, how are you viewing this stretch? Are you getting frustrated that you haven't gotten across the line, or do you think there's reasons for optimism that he can get hot just as he did a year ago right around the PGA Championship?
I have two things can be true on this front. Like, look, I think there's some frustration that he's not getting off to quite the starts that he probably wants. 71 at Doral was not terrible. It was an under par round. However, when you look at what Cam Young was doing in the moment, it clearly wasn't good enough. And as you pointed out, he's lost to some commanding players the last few weeks. It was Roy McIlroy at the Masters. You go to this week, I think Cameron Young is a perfect example of someone that Scotty played well enough to beat everyone else in that field. Cameron Young just had an unbelievable week. I think that part of the logical part of Scotty's head, I think it might take him a minute or two to get there. He probably didn't get there in Miami. He was probably on the plane back to Texas before his mind got around to it. But you're still playing really well. You're still playing Scottie Scheffler golf. You're second every week, week in and week out. That's exactly what a player of Scotty's caliber wants to do. Just give yourself an opportunity on Sunday afternoon.
I mean, it was a blitzkrieg from Cameron Young over the first couple of days that he played with Scottie Scheffler. Scotty said it seemed like he was holding everything at the end of the week after, again, the hot stretch over the final hour of the golf tournament. At least Scotty made up a little bit of a deficit in terms of the putting statistics. Yes, it was still a little bit substandard for his form and what he typically plays. Took about a dozen more putts, hold about 70 feet fewer worth of putts than Cameron Young, but still at least was able to make a little bit of good work. I think the point that you made about the slow starts is what has keeping Scotty out of the winner's circle to this point.
Relatively started, slow, too, again.
Yes.
This is
relative to his high standards and the reason why he's won 2 to 7 times on the PGA Tour since 2022. But Scottie Scheffler has started with a round in the 60s in a PGA Tour event in just 2 of his 9 events this season. Keep in mind, his round one scoring average this season is nearly 3 shots worse than it was a year ago when he was leading the PGA Tour. So I do think that's something to watch for the PGA Championship. Can he get off to a hot start? If he can, like he did at the American Express, it typically ends pretty well. A couple other news and notes, Rex, from Doral. Ben Griffin sighting, a 3-time winner in 2025, posts his best finish of the season. Adam Scott, closing 64, finishes in a tie for 4th. Scotty was 54th in the official World Golf Ranking entering Doral. With this high finish, should be able to lock up a spot in the upcoming U.S. Open. He's already in the PGA Championship. That would then give him 100 consecutive major championship starts. Also wanted to give a shout-out to Alex Fitzpatrick, who tied for 9th after the win at the Zurich Classic. Now he's off and running with his own PGA Tour career. What else stood out to you?
I think the Ben Griffin story was pretty cool because if you kind of connect it to what happened last year, he had a solid week in New Orleans again, and he used that as a spark last year to actually play his way onto the Ryder Cup. And it seems as if he kind of used it as a similar spark because you would look at, even on a golf course like this, you wouldn't expect him to be able to go head-to-head with a guy like a Cameron Young who can just do incredible things from a length point of view with the golf ball. So it was good to see him compete again. But the Adam Scott story is probably the best one. Because I think once you get to 100 consecutive major championships, and we just had a little bit of fun with the idea that Adam Scott won the last PGA Tour event, played at Doral a decade ago, and he's still doing it. I love the idea that he just gets better and better and better. And yes, his putting is going to be suspect from time to time. He has never been and will never be a great, consistent putter. But when he is decent, I think he can definitely still win at a big ballpark on the PGA Tour. I don't think there's limitations. I think sometimes when a player gets into their 40s, even mid-40s when it comes to Adam Scott, that you start saying, well, yeah, he has to do it on certain golf courses. He has to catch lightning in a bottle during the weeks that matter. That's not the case at all with Adam Scott. He hits it plenty well enough to hang with the game's best players. And if he just has a good putting week, then suddenly we're having this conversation about how good he can possibly be.
Made a tweak with his swing coach, Trevor Immelman, who, of course, the CBS broadcaster, over the weekend at Doral, played very well. He's popped up at Riviera. Now popped up at Doral. The tougher the course, the better Adam Scott seems to play. I also did, Rex, want to talk about Doral because you and I did the preview podcast the middle of last week. You and I were both looking forward to the tournament. Got to admit, completely juiceless. There was no one out there, zero fans, zero buzz. I don't quite know the reason. I don't know whether it's signature event fatigue where you've had 3, you're going to have 3 in a 4-week span. Obviously, on Saturday, you had temperatures in the 90s. You had some weather issues that rolled in early Sunday. I think there's the Trump factor as well, not just because he's polarizing, but you also had a heavy security presence on Sunday for the final round, which, of course, was delayed because of weather issues as well. Some talk about the expensive tickets, $100 for a ticket on the weekend. I also think, Rex, there's something to be said for big markets. And I understand the PGA Tour's viewpoint that you want to go to where the eyeballs are. But when you go to these big markets, when you go to a Miami, when you go to a Denver, when you go to Chicago, a New York City, a Boston, a Philly, whatever the case may be, there's more to do there. And there was a pretty big happening in South Florida over the past week with the Formula One Grand Prix in town as well. That's the problem with the big market strategy where you're not necessarily going to have that at the harbor towns or the Travelers Championships of the world as well. But I was just curious your thoughts on what seemed like a pretty juiceless event, this signature event in the Cadillac Championship heading back to Doral for the first time in a decade.
This has got to be my yardstick when it comes to things like this, that Trevor, my middle son, came walking into my office this afternoon. I was getting ready for this show. I was watching the end of the telecast, the tape delayed telecast, and he announces, not really to me, to no one in particular, do you have any idea how expensive a ticket was to Doral? And I'm kind of like, no, I don't buy tickets to golf tournaments, so I can't really. He goes, I would have paid the same for his ticket. I would have paid the same for his ticket that he paid to get into the Players' Championship. And he goes, that's ridiculous. And I'm like, all right, I see what you're saying. And to your point, it is a weird market. Like, not every market is perfect. And I think that, to be unfair to the Miami market, it's not a great sports town. Like, you don't get those.
But two decades ago, Rex, it was a happening. The little
well,
event.
And I'm working back around. I'm working back around to that. When there was a time during the Ford Championship when Eddie Carboni was the tournament director, right? We mentioned this on the Wednesday pod, that one of the most exciting tournaments I covered was the Ford Championship, the year that Tiger and Phil went head-to-head on Sunday afternoon in the final group. Now, granted, that's the perfect recipe, but I also will say that Eddie Carboni and his team in that moment created an atmosphere that was very Miami. He turned it into a Miami party, just not a party, not a concert, not a golf tournament, but he turned it into a Miami party, and it felt cool. It felt neat. It was like a place you wanted to be. So even without Tiger and Phil on Sunday afternoon, there was still a vibe to that tournament that I think really resonated with the community. Ever since then, and very shortly after that, Championship Management, which is essentially the PGA Tour's arm, I think now it's called PGA Tour Events, took over the event at Doral. And this isn't a knock against Championship Management or PGA Tour Events so much as it is, if you're not in a community, whether especially Miami being such a unique place, but if you're not in a community like Miami, like New Orleans, you probably don't have a very good connection to what makes an event special, what motivates a sports fan in that area. And I think that's what they ran into and continue to run into. Yes, it's expensive. Yes, sometimes big markets, they're big markets for a reason. There's a lot going on in Miami right now. And sometimes you just don't connect with the market. I think it was a combination of all of those things. You're right. It was lifeless. There was no buzz on property. There were no real fans. I remember back in the day, I kind of wanted to go back to Doral. I was kind of bummed I wasn't able to be down there this week because of the schedule. But I mentioned this on the Wednesday podcast. I had a colleague of ours say, I don't want to go down there. I want to remember Doral for the way it was, not what they're trying to create.
Yeah, I think you make a lot of great points there. It did feel like sort of a sanitized or a watered-down version of the old WGCs, which, of course, went the way of yesteryear as well. The golf course is a little bit monotonous, a little bit bland. Did not play, I don't think, particularly well on television this time around. And I don't think the schedule, Rex, helped matters as well. And I'm led to believe that this is a one-off in terms of where and when this tournament was played. Keep in mind, two decades ago, it used to kick off the Florida Swing. You know, you'd still have big events back in Tiger's heyday. He would be playing Torrey. You would have Phil at Pebble. You'd have the WGC match play with the 64 best players in the world. But Doral was then played to kick off the Florida Swing, and it signaled that the Masters was right around the corner. You had the Players' Championship 3 weeks later. I really do think that Doral works better, if not as a leadoff event. It certainly sounds like the American Express in La Quinta is going to be the leadoff event for the 2027 PGA Tour season. At least have it batting second or third in the lineup just to get it out of this congested part of the season where players are looking ahead, they're looking behind, they're trying to conserve energy for what is a daunting remaining few months of the season, trying to preserve energy for the FedEx Cup playoffs at the end of the major championship season as well. So I think it works better second or third and not necessarily at this point in the year. All right, we alluded to it, but after the break, we're going to be doing a draft. Yes, a draft of which players, if you're the PGA Tour executives, would you want to re-enter the PGA Tour and in what order, what priority? It's coming up after this short break. All right, Rex, we're about 2 weeks removed from the NFL draft, and there was a lot of chatter on social media about consensus big boards and what's a good value. Are teams like my Jaguars potentially reaching for certain players a couple rounds ahead of time? Don't you worry about that. We're not looking at 2026. We're looking at 2027 and beyond. We don't know what's going to happen with LIV players and if they're going to need to find an eventual place to play other than LIV golf. So let's, Rex, play a mock draft where if you're the PGA Tour, who do you want if you're on the clock and can reintegrate some of these players? You and I flipped the AirPods case. I won the draft. I have the number one pick. And so my number one pick in the PGA Tour reentry draft is John Rahm. And to me, this
is
pretty obvious. This is a generational talent who fits the PGA Tour and what they're trying to do in the future by making it the most competitive, the most cutthroat tour on the planet. I think with an added bonus, Rex, that John Rahm, whenever, if he comes back to the PGA Tour, is going to be a villain upon his return. I think it makes him even more intriguing when he eventually gets himself back into contention and is playing against all the best players in the world again.
I mean, full disclosure, John Rahm's on my big board here right next to me. So yeah, very good pick. I don't think anybody's going to doubt that. And like, look,
Fernando Mendoza of our draft.
He is the Fernando Mendoza of our draft, just not quite as happy or easygoing or easy on the interviews as Fernando Mendoza is. But I will say that I think you're right. I think if he comes back, and that is a big if, like this is not part of the equation right now. We assume that John Rahm is going to find a way to make his way back to the PGA Tour. And that's a big leap as we stand right now. I'm leaning into assume really heavily. If he does come back, I think you're absolutely right. I think he picks up where he left off. He is still one of those players that week in and week out, you know he can win on the PGA Tour. He still has so much firepower to do it, just not at a tour event, but at a major championship in the Ryder Cup. He doesn't seem to buckle under pressure. Everything you would want from a player. Because you forced my hand, and I did not anticipate to have to do this, I'm going to take Bryson DeChambeau. I'm going to do it reluctantly, and here is why.
Reluctantly with the number two overall pick.
I am. Yeah, I wanted to hear the music here first, but I kind of jumped the gun on it. However, here's why. I still think, and this is a big if as well, if he comes back to the PGA Tour, I'm not even quite sure he wants to come back to the PGA Tour. But if he is, we have seen what he's able to do when he's in full Bryson mode. We've seen him dismantle top fields and top golf courses at Wingfoot. We saw him do it at Pinehurst. We've seen him do it now on LIV Golf. We saw him do it when he was on the PGA Tour. It's going to be difficult to motivate him from time to time and to play a full schedule. And I know there's going to be things that are going to be tough. In this particular case, I needed a defensive end, but there was a running back I had to take because he was the best available in the draft, and that's Bryson DeChambeau.
Yeah, look, I don't think you're going to need the full 10 minutes or 8 minutes, whatever it is between selections in order to make the number two pick. It's pretty obviously Bryson. If you're the PGA Tour executives, you would want him back into the fold. He's an immensely popular player. But the reason why I also had him at number two on my consensus big board is that I do worry about his longevity. He turns 33 years old later on this fall. He's already not just hinted, Rex, but suggested that he could be satiated by other interests outside of professional golf, whether it's just going leaning in full time with YouTube content creation. And so regardless of if he's playing the Truist Championship or he's playing the Travelers Championship, he's always going to sort of have his mind elsewhere. The major championships are where his legacy and his tradition are going to be wrapped up and what his resume is eventually going to look at. He was never... I think even when he was a full-time PGA Tour player, he was always interested in something else. I think if you're the PGA Tour, you're a little bit leery of that sort of scenario where is he half-hearted in some of his PGA Tour attempts, where I think John Rahm is full bore trying to make amends and potentially trying to repair some of his reputation. I think you and I both agree, Rex, that there is a pretty significant drop-off from one and two for the rest of this draft. You look at the returning member program on the PGA Tour, that player was Cameron Smith. I'm going in a different direction, though, with number three. For me, that is Tyrrell Hatton as number three on my big board. 8 European Tour wins. He's now, over the past year, getting himself into the hunt at the major championships as well. Had a great opportunity to win the U.S. Open last year at Oakmont. This, I would argue, is actually one of the players who has actually helped his game by moving to LIV Golf for whatever reason. He seems to have elevated in different ways and produced his best golf in the major championships, where a lot of the players who have gone to LIV have tailed off in that department. So I'm going Tyrrell Hatton, who is still very much in the prime of his career.
I feel like you have a spy in my war room because we keep going. Hopefully this is going to break right here. This will be the last one because I had Hatton next for all the reasons that you pointed out. He has been one of the few players that seem to have gotten better and better since he went to LIV Golf. That was a pretty easy pick. Wait a minute. Is it my turn? Is it the fourth
pick? It is.
Can I hear it? Can I hear it?
Let's hear the song.
There it is. That's music to my ears.
Sweet sound of the draft.
I love that. How can you create an event that's so far away from the season that gets people excited? And that's how the NFL did it. I'm going to go with Joaquin Niemann with my pick. And here's the idea. And this goes back to he has not had a great season this year. I don't know that he had necessarily a great season last year. I love what he did in his first season on LIV Golf, where he realized that to play in the events that matter, the major championships, he had to go above and beyond what your John Rahms and your Bryson DeChambeaus had to do and your Brooks Koepkas at the time. They were already qualified. He had to work harder than the other players to do it. And I love the fact that he did it. As I said, he seems to have fallen off a little bit, but I truly don't think that's an indication of his game or where he is in his career right now. I think he's probably in a funk like a lot of LIV players right now. He probably came into this season with a lot of uncertainty. And I always go back to a story I wrote for the Masters Journal a few years ago. And I was trying to come up with like a working list of give me the top five players of the current generation that for, and I came up with 10 bullet points, 10 sort of categories to judge from would be the best. And I had this panel of all kinds of different people to be the judge. And I went to Brandel Chambly. He was a member of the panel. And he went, Joaquin Neiman. It was the five. And he kind of walked through why he felt so bullish. And the biggest thing is the swing and the technique is sound. It's as sound as anyone else on the PGA Tour. But he just had a fight in them.
Yeah, I mean, Joaquin Neiman in 2025, at least according to Data Golf, was one of the best players in the world, Rex. He won five LIV events, even though he did not win the season-long individual titles, which belonged to John Rahm somewhat oddly, despite him not winning a golf tournament. I would also think, Rex, that Joaquin Neiman, who is a two-time winner on the PGA Tour, he still has plenty of runway ahead of him at the age of 27, even if the swing gives you a little bit of hesitation with the sort of the strain and the torque on the lower back. I'm with you. Joaquin Neiman was very much in my top five as well. For my number five overall pick, I'm going, and I think you could probably classify this as a projection for the future, but I'm going David Puig, who is just 24 years old, has shown a lot in his starts on LIV. He's already won on the European Tour. He was a great college player at Arizona State. He's so explosive, has a lot of firepower, hits it a long ways. I can just see him on golf courses like Doral. I can see him on golf courses like Quail Hollow, where it gets tough and distance is at such a premium and at such an advantage that he could really carve out a nice PGA Tour career if he is given the opportunity to do so. Has never had PGA Tour status in his career. So he would be among the players I'd be very interested to see how and what sort of pathway, if any, PGA Tour executives create for players like that. But David Puig, it's my number five overall pick.
I like this. And you and I got a peek, but I wasn't even cheating. I'll show you my big board. I'm going with Tom McKibben for a lot of the same reasons that you just pointed out. If I'm drafting and I'm trying to pick, it's not a team, but if I was trying to pick a team for the future, you wanted to lean into youth. And I think between those two players, David and Tom McKibben, those would be the two top young players I think that LIV Golf has right now. And he has shown all kinds of signs of being a special type of player since he emerged. I think he has all the tools that he needs. I think he probably needs a couple more starts worldwide and specifically on the PGA Tour to get comfortable and competing at that level, making the next step up. But I love him for sort of that youth movement as my third pick.
Yeah, look, 23 years old. He's already won on the European Tour. And if you listen to advanced scout Roy McIlroy, who is, you know, he's made pretty significant headways in the NFL scouting community, Rory McIlroy has, he said, Rex, that he wants Tom McKibben on the PGA Tour. And if he's talking to Tom McKibben, he's trying to steer him away from LIV Golf to make sure that he accepts one of those 10 PGA Tour cards that he had by virtue of finishing among the top 10 in the Race to Dubai standings. That's a pretty good indication that if Rory thinks highly of you and wants you in the PGA Tour, you must be a pretty talented player. I'm with you. Tom McKibben was going to be my next couple of picks. So with that in mind, I would need probably a couple minutes to make this pick, but I'm going to go with Cameron Smith. Look, he certainly seems very content with his lot in life on LIV Golf right now, was among the players who did not accept PGA Tour's offer earlier this season to return the PGA Tour by virtue of what he'd done since 2022. And look, it's very, very likely that what happened that year, winning the Players' Championship, winning another event, winning the Open Championship as well at the Old Course at St. Andrews, that very likely is going to serve as the high mark of his career. That's okay. 2015 and 2017 are very likely to serve as the high marks of Jordan Spieth's career as well. He can still have a nice career on the PGA Tour. I still love seeing his short game. I still love seeing that putting stroke. He has flashed at times as Cameron Smith, even though he's been a little bit more inconsistent than we're used to, particularly in the major championships, nearly won in Australia late last year. So I like Cameron Smith. If the PGA Tour can find a way to get him back on the PGA Tour, I think he could be a potential boon. So he's my pick there.
I think from the PGA Tour's perspective, he was one of those four players that were offered the returning member program. I think they look at him as sort of one of those stars that can be that magnetic pull to events that TV loves. I will say, as I went down the list, and it's the sound that you make, I'm not even going to try to do it, but every time we bring up someone, do you want to? Yep, there it is. That's the sound. I want to turn that in to this sound more than the chimes, because I love what Cam Smith was able to accomplish. I love the idea that he followed what he wanted to do, spend more time at home, compete internationally. I don't know, because as I was going down my list, did you give Dustin Johnson a second look? He might be your next pick for all I know. My guess is he was not. And I think there's going to be a lot of players who, if and when LIV Golf does in fact end, they're just going to be more than willing to step away from the game. I don't know that Cam is going to be that player, but I just haven't seen that fire from him since he joined LIV Golf that was there beforehand. I'm going to keep the youth movement going with my next pick. I'm going to go with Jose Luis Ballester. And I love what he's done. That came out of nowhere. I love what he's been able to do in his first season after leaving college, and he had a great college career. But he played solid from start to finish. There was no learning curve. There was no drop off. He won on the international stage during that rookie year. He's off to another solid start. I like the idea. I'm keeping it young.
Look, when he's not peeing in Ray's Creek, he's proven that he is a very talented player. U.S. Amateur champ. He won the Saudi International. He's been mentored, rightly or wrongly, by Sergio Garcia on LIV Golf. He was among my top 10 favorites as well. I do think he can have a nice career. He's, again, just like David Pooge, just like Tom McKibben. You can throw Caleb Surratt in the same sort of category as well. Jose Ballester, if he is given the opportunity, could be one of those players who sort of fortifies the middle class. We look at what LIV Golf really robbed from the PGA Tour. There was some top-end names. There was some past their prime players. There were some villains on the PGA Tour. But I think when you really look at what LIV Golf robbed from the PGA Tour, it was that 25 to 75 player range, the middle class. All of these young players can develop maybe into stars, but I think really top-end talent that makes the PGA Tour product as a whole a little bit stronger. All right, this is my last pick in the top 10. You mentioned Dustin Johnson. I am not picking him here. Although I think Dustin Johnson would be immensely popular among his peers, although Dustin Johnson might not have anything left at this age, he's still a 30-time winner around the world, including 24 times on the PGA Tour. His lifetime status, lifetime exemption on the PGA Tour, if he so wants it. I'm with you, though. He could be in the Cameron Smith category, is completely content and complacent, and that's perfectly okay. And so I'm going for a little bit of a wild card. And for my pick, I'm going with Anthony Kim. Whew. At this stage in the draft, if we're only going to have a 10-pick draft, I might as well take a flyer on AK just to see if there's anything left. We saw what he did earlier this year, winning in Adelaide, outdoing John Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau. So you know it's in there. So you know that sort of talent is still in there. And look, maybe he flames out after a year on the PGA Tour going up against the best on a week-in and week-out basis. But at least you'd know. You think PGA Tour fans would have a little bit of closure after they were left wondering what happened to the former rising star who left the game under mysterious circumstances only to reappear and earn a whole bunch of Saudi riches. I think a one-year flyer on Anthony Kim, see if he can extend this hot streak or if he just sort of flames out. I think at this stage of the draft, I want to see what you got.
Well, and I guess at this point, it's funny, we would never even have had this conversation just a few months ago, and I do think it's interesting, but what are we drafting here? Are we drafting a name that's going to bring attention to the PGA Tour? Are we drafting stars who are going to be able to play and compete on a week-in and week-out basis? Because
if you listen to Brian Rolapp, he wants anyone who can make the PGA Tour better. So if I'm looking at my roster construction, I've got players who I believe can make the PGA Tour better. I'm talking about John Rahm, Terrell Hatton, projection on David Pooge. But I think there's a whole host of other factors to put in here, and that would be AK from an entertainment standpoint. And again, sort of touching and sort of keying in on the fans who clearly resonated with his victory just a couple of months ago.
No, you're not wrong. I'm just not going down that road. That's not what my list was made of. I'm not trying to sell tickets. I'm trying to field the best possible five players I possibly can. And that's no disrespect to Anthony Kim, because I think both you and I have been pretty clear about it. It's been amazing what he's been able to accomplish. There is no comparison to what he has done in professional golf and all of professional sports. Someone who just walked away for a decade plus and just disappeared and was a ghost. No one saw him. No one heard from him. He was just this mystery, and just to show back up. And it took him a while to get back to speed. But you're right. It's a very cool story. It's going to sell tickets. It's going to get TV executives interested. That's not how I constructed my team. So with that in mind, Mr. Irrelevant, the last pick of the 2026 Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav, is going to be Thomas Dietrich. Yes, Thomas Dietrich. I still feel like he has so much to prove. You look at where he is in Data Golf's rankings, which I think is the only way to really rank them. I think after Hatton, he has probably been, that's not fair either. But after John Rahm and Hatton, he's probably the hottest player right now on that tour from a week in and week out basis. And I do think when you look at what he's done, not just on Live Golf, but what he did before he even left, I think he was on a trajectory of being a top 10 player in the world. So Mr. Irrelevant, Thomas Dietrich.
I like Thomas Dietrich. I think he's a fine player. I thought the win last year in Phoenix was a revelation. He couldn't obviously build on that. I feel like in this draft, though, that's like taking offensive guard. No one wants to do it.
It's sometimes you need an offensive guard, man.
But all of a sudden, he's going to put up top 12 finishes for you on the PGA Tour.
Well, I took an offensive guard, and you took Diego Pavia. So you can see we're vastly different GMs.
That's a great point. When I'm looking at my roster, Rex, that's John Rahm, Terrell Hatton, David Pooge, Cam Smith, and AK. I feel like James Gladstone. I feel like the GM of the Jaguars, who said that he nailed all but one of his picks in the 2026 draft. Every draft Nick known to man has been absolutely crushing the Jags for how they handle the draft. I'm like Gladdy, absolutely believer in what I was doing here. What's your final pick?
Which draft pick did you not get right? If you feel like you crushed them all except for one, is there one that you're, if I gave you a do-over, would you do over?
I wanted Neiman on my team if I could get him.
Oh, well, you didn't have him. I mean, that's not, yeah, you can't.
You swiped him. You swiped him.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Bryson DeChambeau, Joaquin Neiman, Tom McKibben, Jose, you're going to help me with
by a stare.
Thank you, Mr. Ballester. And Mr. Irrelevant, Thomas Dietrich. I like all of my picks, and you're right. I think you and I sort of approach this from a vastly different angle. You're looking to sell tickets and make TV executives happy and to make sponsors happy. I'm looking at who has the potential of being a player that can win week in and week out on the PGA Tour, who has all the tools right now to go out and develop into who could be a Ryder Cup hero for either side, the U.S. side or the European side, who could win major championships. I kind of went into it, and I like all of my picks. I don't know if I would compare it. This is probably not a very good comparison because I wasn't entirely happy with my Commanders draft, but I probably would compare it to that because there were some offensive guards there that I didn't particularly like either.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Let us know in the YouTube comment section which draft was better. The obvious answer is mine. All right, coming up after this short break, we're going to do a Voices in the Crowd section. You had questions. We've got some answers. Stay with us. All right, guys, it's time for the Voices in the Crowd section. We always love hearing from you, whether it's on YouTube, on social media. This one actually was from listener Tommy, who sent me a good old-fashioned email, and he said the tour should make the Live guys pay back their signing bonus. Would anyone do it, Rex?
I was just checking social media. Mel Kiper's got some thoughts on your draft. You should circle back around and see what he have to say about that. I think I love the idea that people are coming up with creative ways to bring the players back. I think if you look at John Rahm as the sort of the litmus test here, and he doesn't want to give up anything. So the idea that he's only going to come back if he gives up something, all of that money that they paid him, it's just not going to happen. I understand where David is coming from. I get the idea, but we're not going to get any of them back if that's
his name is not David. His name is Tommy. Thank you for listening.
Tommy.
And thank you for the support, Tommy. I also disagree with this, Rex. Like, part of the reason for the signing bonuses that Liv was even handing out was that it was luring these players to take the risk. You know, this could potentially have been career suicide. And for some of them, it was. They needed to make the risk worth their while, and thus they paid 8 and 9 figure signing bonuses. I think Brooks Koepka is a great example here. In the returning member program, he needed to make a $5 million donation. He has made $1.2 million this season on the PGA Tour. So it's not nothing. However, compared to his Live bonuses, in which he earned $45 million, just on the golf course, not even making mention of the nine-figure deal that he had with Liv. It's still pocket change of these guys. I don't see them forfeiting any sort of signing bonuses. That was the reason why they left. That was the reason why we've been in this mess for the past 3 or 4 years. How about this one from Jim Iverson, who said the top players have always wanted to just play 18 to 20 times. Any more than that, they're going to skip. Do you agree?
I agree. And especially when you look at the way this schedule is going to be condensed. If you stretched out 18 to 20 events from January to December, yeah, I bet you could make that schedule work and make it fun and go to some cool places and probably almost have something close to full participation. If you're going to cram it into the window, essentially, that we've been talking about, the week before the Super Bowl, maybe we sort of kick that around and then in the week before Labor Day, no. They're not going to do anything more than that. I think once you start getting back-to-back weeks, we're in the middle of it right now. We're seeing it week in and week out. Scotty's skipping 1 week. Rory's skipping the next week. Xander's skipping. I just think players aren't going to play that many consecutive weeks in a row.
Especially if it's Scottie Scheffler or Rory McIlroy, who at this point are the top two players on the PGA Tour. That's why I think it is imperative for the PGA Tour to build in those off weeks and space them out accordingly to make sure that it is benefiting the top players. How about this one from OG Jack, who said, remember when Payne Stewart switched clubs? The results were not positive. He's obviously alluding to the fact that Justin Rose beat just two players at the Cadillac Championship after switching to McLaren Irons.
There's a lot of cautionary tales in there, but I think Rosie is probably at a stage of his career where he's comfortable with the decisions he's made.
I agree with that. This also wasn't just a McLaren issue as it relates to Justin Rose. I would also point out that he gained strokes with his approach play, top 16 in each of the last two rounds. Really poor week on and around the greens as well. This one from JD Stan. Lav is a horrible indictment of the University of Georgia academics. That, of course, is talking about my pronunciation of Bayou on the Wednesday
right.
podcast. Rex, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
It's certainly not a Bayou.
No, it most certainly not. I'm ashamed. I took a couple days to reflect on what I'd done. I love New Orleans. I love the Bayou. I love Louisiana in general. Apologies to all my friends there. I hope not to disappoint you next time. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. It's going to be a busy week for both of us. I'm in Connecticut, clearly, to co-host Golf Today alongside Eamon Lynch, while Rex will be on the road in Charlotte for the Truist Championship. We'll be the Golf Central reporter this week ahead of the PGA Championship. So thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days for the Midweek Podcast.